Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
First day of the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on that very day, they came to the desert of Sinai. After they set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did in Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites." So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, "I am going to come to you in a dense cloud, so the people will hear me speaking with you and will always put their trust in you." Then jumping down to verse 16. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. As the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. Then if we go down to chapter 20, we get to the Ten Commandments. It says this, "And God spoke all these words, 'I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or in the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work. Honor your father and your mother, so you may live long in the land of the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet anything that belongs to your neighbor." When the people saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance and said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not have God speak to us or we will die." Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. God has come to test you so that the fear of God will be with you to keep you from sinning." The people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. When Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice, "Everything the Lord has said, we will do." Moses then wrote down everything the Lord has said. He got up early the next morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he set young Israelite men and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and put it in bowls, and the other half he splashed against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it to the people. They responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey." Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, "This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Let's welcome Tim now as he comes to speak.
Thank you, Chris. No, that was a long one, but it's an important one, which is why I had Chris read so much of it. Anyway, welcome to Christchurch on this somewhat overcast August afternoon. I hope that's not the end of the summer. I really do. But the leaves are falling off the trees. What's up with that? It's only August. We are on week 9 of a series looking at the life of Moses that will take us all the way through to the end of September. And this week, we're going to be looking at another one of the major events of Moses' life, up there with the plagues and the passing of the Red Sea. And that is the giving of the Ten Commandments. I mean, what were the plagues and the commandments? The number 10 obviously has some significance for the life of Moses. And I don't know if you've ever noticed it, but Tom, our designer, actually hid the number 10 in this slide. Has anyone seen that? What about now? How many people actually knew that was there out of interest? Yeah, this morning, hardly anyone either. This has been up for 8 weeks, people. 8 Sundays, and you haven't seen it. And not only do you have, I think this is one of my favorite slides Tom's ever done for us. Not only do you have the number 10, you have the shepherd's staff, which we've seen throughout this series as a sign of God's symbol and power. You have the mountains in the background, so that's where Moses met God at the burning bush. Actually, these are in Afghanistan rather than Sinai, but we'll forget about that in a minute. And then obviously you have the burning bush, which I think looks a lot like Lion-O from the Thundercats. Do you not think? I mean, I asked Tom about that, and he said that wasn't his inspiration, but, I mean, that is just uncanny. Anyway, we're not here to talk about the Thundercats, although we could, because it's a great TV show. We're here to talk about something a little bit more important than that. We're going to be looking at how God gave Moses and the Israelites the Ten Commandments to teach them a new way to live. But before we go there and do that, I just want to start by reminding ourselves of something that I think is important to remember whenever we talk about the law, whenever we talk about commands of God to obey, and that is grace. Because if you're anything like me, you can easily jump straight from talking about the law to thinking that it's all about what I do and don't do to make myself acceptable to God. So let's just quickly back up and read verses 4 and 5 again. God said to Moses, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession." Do you see what comes first and what comes second? Rescue comes first, salvation comes first, acceptance by God of the Israelites comes first, obedience comes second. Obedience is a response to God. It is not required by God before he makes the first move towards us. The only thing the Israelites had to do was to trust in God, to put their faith in him to save them by walking out of Egypt. In fact, walking is too strong a verb for God. God says, "I carried you out." The image is of a mighty eagle swooping down to rescue them. God makes the point that the Israelites contributed absolutely nothing to their deliverance. They didn't fight their way out of Egypt. They didn't negotiate their way out. They didn't even walk out as far as he was concerned. They were carried out by him. He did it all because of his great love for them, and it had absolutely nothing to do with how morally good they were. You see, God doesn't give the Ten Commandments to Moses at the burning bush. He doesn't tell him to take them down to the Israelites with the message, "This is my law, and if you keep it perfectly for the next 6 months, I will come down and rescue you." Like some kind of half-yearly performance review. You know, well done, Israelites, all these performance criteria we talked about last time. Yeah, we've done that, so great, rescue's on. That did not happen. God acts first. He redeems them from slavery first as an act of sheer grace. And then he makes a covenant with them and asks them to obey. Out of gratitude, as a response to this amazing grace. This is how God spoke then, and this is how God speaks to us now. He says, "I have completely accepted you already. I've done everything necessary to save you already, even though you don't deserve it at all, because I love you. Now, therefore, obey me." Every other religion in the world operates on the opposite principle. Every other religion teaches that if you do right and live right and say right, then you will be acceptable to God. It is only then, if you have performed well enough, that you can get close to God, that you can be in relationship with him. And in fact, it's not just religions that teach that. This idea seems to be embedded in every human heart. The principle appears to be a default setting. The thought that if I am a good person, if I am good at my job, if I make a name for myself, if I'm clever or beautiful or funny or talented, then and only then will I be accepted. Then and only then will I be loved. Then and only then will I know that I'm okay. But right here in black and white, we have the model for how God deals with us. He is the one that moves first. He doesn't wait for us to reach a certain level of spiritual maturity or enlightenment before coming to us. He doesn't wait for us to reach an acceptable level of morality before offering us a relationship with him, even though he could do. He doesn't even wait for us to move towards him, to kind of move halfway, to meet him halfway. He runs towards us as fast as he can because he loves us and wants to be with us. So if God didn't give the Ten Commandments as a way of helping to straighten out the Israelites in order to make them acceptable, why did he give them? Well, in verse 6, we have the answer. He says, "To make the Israelites into a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Through the commandments, God is going to teach them a new and a distinctive way to live. For the last 400 years, the Israelites have been living amongst the Egyptians. They were living separately from the Egyptian people in their own kind of the land because of their ethnicity. They were all descended from the 12 sons of Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, a Hebrew. So they were all Hebrews by ethnicity, and the Egyptians and the Hebrews didn't socially mix. But it's hard to know how distinctive they were as a people group with regards to their customs and even religion. We're not really told anything about the period between the death of the sons and the birth of Moses, this huge 400-year period. But I think it would be safe to assume that after all that time living and working side by side, they had probably taken on some of the surrounding cultures, worldviews and customs, and maybe even religions. Which means that amongst the Israelites, and especially amongst those from other nations who had joined the Israelites in the Exodus, there are probably a range of opinions, a range of viewpoints on which God or which gods to worship and how to do that, on how society should be ordered and what things should and should not be done. So what God is doing here is explaining to them how things are to be in this brand new nation state. He's effectively laying out a new constitution for a new civilization, a new way of living and being that is fitting for a people that has the Lord, that has Yahweh as their God. And it's a constitution that isn't based upon the whim of an earthly king, which all the other cultures around them and their constitutions were just based upon whatever the king said. And it wasn't one that had evolved over centuries and centuries by trial and error. It was based upon the very character and nature of Yahweh, of God himself. And the evidence that these commandments are from God and not man-made is that God delivers them not in secret to one special person, but to the whole of the nation. He gathers them all around this mountain and he thunders to them out of the cloud, and all of them hear these Ten Commandments. And so God's intention is to teach them how to live as a truly free people. And in doing so, to make them into a nation that is set apart, that is distinctive, that is different from all of those around it, which is able to show the world by the way that it lives what their God is really like. And I guess one of the things that is immediately clear when you read the Ten Commandments is that God is interested in the whole of their lives. Not just some of it, not just the quote-unquote religious parts, everything. Many of the commentaries make this point by dividing up the Ten Commandments like this. So you've got 1 to 4 that deal with the people's responsibilities to God. And then 5 is to do with the family. And then 6 to 10, the people's responsibilities to one another, to society as a whole. And you can even see a pattern on top of that as well. So the first two commandments are to do with the thoughts about God. And then you move to the words said about God and then the deeds done towards God. And you've got the honoring your parents in the middle, which kind of encompasses all those three things, thought, words, and deeds. And then you flip that around and you start with deeds to one another, moving to words and then to thoughts. This symmetry depicts a complete, all-encompassing, rounded law for a rounded life that is pleasing to God. So from the Ten Commandments, you see that God is not just concerned with actions, but also with motives of the heart. And he's not just concerned with what could be termed the sacred, with religious expression and worship, but with the secular, with day-to-day life. As you read the rest of Exodus, and as you look into the next two books of the Old Testament, Leviticus and Deuteronomy, where the rest of the law is given, you see just how concerned God is that his people live their whole lives as an expression of their faith in him. Every area of Israelite life is covered in those laws, from farming to worship to business practices to welfare provision to sexual ethics to family rights to public holidays and feasts to dietary laws to settling legal disputes and everything in between. As far as God is concerned, a sacred and secular divide just does not exist. All of life was considered sacred, to be set apart to God. All of life was to be lived in such a way as to faithfully and accurately reflect the character and nature of God, to bring glory to him. In fact, one of the chief complaints that God has against the people of Israel, something that comes up time and time again as you read through the scriptures, is that they get very good at doing the religious stuff. They get good at offering sacrifices and going to the temple to worship and to fast and pray and sound pious. But they forget all about living the rest of their lives in a way that is pleasing to God too. Throughout their history at different times, they forget all about justice for the poor and the oppressed. They forget all about looking after their parents in their old age. They forget all about making money in a way that is good for the whole community and then sharing their proceeds generously around. And often it is the prophets of God, his spokespeople, who are called upon to remind them of their duty to live out their faith in the whole of their life. For example, the prophet Isaiah in chapter 58 calls the people to task for making a big song and dance about how great they are at fasting and how much they do it and aren't they amazing for fasting, whilst at the same time they're ignoring the plight of the poor amongst them. Is this not the kind of fasting I have chosen, God says through Isaiah, to loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? When you see the naked, to clothe them, and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood. Through the Ten Commandments, God is calling the people, calling us to a new way of living that reflects his heart in every area of life. Which means that being a Christian, being a disciple of Jesus, should affect everything. The way that we work, the way that we parent, the way that we shop, the kind of neighbors and kind of citizens we are, how we get involved in politics, the kinds of friends that we are, how we spend our free time, even the things that we think about. And part of the job of being a disciple is to work out what it looks like to live every single part of your life in a way that brings honor to God. Now, I do understand that this can sound a little heavy, can't it? It can sound to the untrained ear a little like God is just this cosmic policeman with this huge list of rules about every single thing imaginable, ready just to punish us whenever we step out of line. But that really couldn't be further from the truth. This is what God says in Deuteronomy 5, speaking about why he wants the Israelites to keep his commands. He says, "Oh, that their hearts would be inclined to fear me and keep all my commands always, so that it might go well with them and their children forever." God's desire is that we follow his commands because his commands are good and they bring life to us. His commands are the blueprint for human flourishing. And he wants us to follow them because following them does us good. And as the designer and creator of everything, including humanity, including us, I think we can safely assume that he probably knows best. I heard Andy Samberg tell this great story on a chat show a while back. For those of you who don't know, Andy Samberg is a comedian, American comedian, started out on Saturday Night Live, and then he's got his own TV show, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is hilarious, and is also something I can recommend from the front of church, and those two things don't always go together, so double bonus. Anyway, this next picture is of him with Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook. He'd basically been flown out to Facebook HQ. Every year, Mark Zuckerberg does this keynote address to all of the Facebook employees, and they flew out Samberg to kind of gatecrash that and to do an impersonation of him and to give the keynote address. And afterwards, they're sitting together in his office, and it came up in conversation that Samberg didn't actually have a Facebook account. A little embarrassing. And Mark Zuckerberg's like, "Well, why? Why would you not have a Facebook account? I mean, everyone has a Facebook account." And Samberg is just like, "Well, I'm in contact with all the people I want to be in contact with. I just don't need one." He's like, "Come on, dude, you have to have one. You're here now. Let me set one up for you." And so that's exactly what he does. In his office, he sets up an account. But there are two provisions that Andy Samberg gives. He says, one, it must be a private account. And two, you're going to be my only friend. So it's going to be a private account. I don't want anyone else friending me up. I don't want any of your friends getting contact. I will just say, I have an account, and we'll leave it at that. And so Mark Zuckerberg says, fine, we'll set this up for you. Everything's fine. The week following, Andy Samberg starts getting all of these email requests, friend requests from all of Zuckerberg's friends. And I think he's like friends with everyone on Facebook. So there's a lot of requests. And Andy Samberg is like, man, this is annoying. But I don't really know what to do about this. I don't know how Facebook works. So do you know what he does? He calls up Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, for some tech support. So he calls him up and said, dude, you said you sort this and it's not sorted. Like, what do I do? And Zuckerberg kind of tells him, all right, if you go to your settings and if you untick this and tick that, then everything will be fine. And so he does that and he sorts everything out. Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, the founder of Facebook, ends up giving this guy tech support. I mean, I guess there's no better person to do that, really. We would all do that if we had access to him. If we've got a problem with Facebook, we'd go to the man himself if we had access. Do you get the point? God made us. He designed us. He invented us. He knows how we work. Maybe the smartest thing to do is to go to him. And the amazing thing is that we have access to him. But that's not the only reason. Yes, God made us. He knows what is best for us. And he is creator. He is creator God, worthy of devotion and obedience, even if he never did anything for us, just for being creator God. But the scriptures reveal that God is also a God who not only relates to his creation as creator, he not only relates to his people as king, he also relates to us as a father relating to his children, a father who loves his children and wants the best for them. As some of you may know, Jax, my wife, and I have two little girls. This is them, Olivia, who is just turned 3, Ariana, who's just turned 6 months. And so we are at the very early stages of parenting. And if you spend any amount of time with us when we're with Olivia, you will hear us telling Olivia what to do a lot. I mean, all the time. It's constant. You just have to instruct her every single moment. I mean, when you think about it, this parenting thing is a little crazy. You go into hospital and you have the baby. The wife has the baby. Obviously, it's hard for the guy as well, but you know, the wife has the baby. And then you're not allowed to take your baby out. You have to get your baby signed out, which is, I guess, is good to make sure that you're not stealing someone else's baby. But all that they do is they make sure that the names match. That's it. They don't check for qualifications. They don't check that you've done a course in parenting. They don't check any of that. I mean, if it's your baby, they give you the baby. And now you have this little person that you have to teach how to be a person. You have to socialize them into normal society. And so we have to teach Olivia everything. I mean, we teach her the practical stuff, like how to brush her teeth, how to get dressed, how to put the right shoes on the right feet, which is something that happens every single time. I still left, Olivia, left. We get to teach her the fun stuff, like how to ride a bike and how to swim and how to draw. This is actually a picture that she drew of me last week. It's just uncanny, isn't it? There's resemblance. Remember, she's 3. This is amazing. Proud dad moment. Anyway, then there's the life and death stuff, like not climbing out of our third floor window, not running into traffic, that you can't breathe underwater. We've had to teach her all of these things. I mean, she learned that one pretty quick. And then we get to teach her the important stuff too, like being a little girl who does what she says that she's going to do. How to be assertive without being demanding. I mean, there's a fine line there. You don't want her to be demanding and bossy, but you want her to be assertive. And especially as a dad of a little girl who's going to grow up and there'll be boys involved, you want her to be very assertive. So we're trying to teach her that. We're trying to teach her how to say sorry when she's done something wrong, how to say please and thank you, how to forgive, and also how to accept forgiveness. And most of all, we want to teach her that we love her no matter what, that she is ours. And because nothing can ever change that, nothing will ever change our love for her. Now, we are very, very far from perfect parents. Most of the time, it feels like we're just kind of fumbling around in the dark with this stuff. We're trying to do our best, but it will no doubt get to a point where we'll look back and we will see that actually some of the stuff that we taught her, some of the advice that we gave her, probably the example that we unwittingly gave her, was not the best thing for her after all. But believe me, our intentions are good. We really do want the best for her and Ariana. We want them to thrive and to flourish. And God is just the same as that, except infinitely wiser and infinitely more loving, which means his commands to us can be trusted to be the best thing possible for us, even if they don't look like it in the moment. And I get that they don't always look like that. For the single person to hear that it is better to be single than to get together with someone who does not share their faith, I get that that may not sound like the most life-giving advice. I get that giving away a portion of your hard-earned money to the church when you could be putting that towards a deposit doesn't always sound like the smartest thing. I get that trying to follow Jesus, to be faithful to him, can bring a lot of heartache and frustration and pain. But it's in those moments where it's most important to remind ourselves that God can be trusted. Because not only does he know what he's doing, not only did he make us, he loves us like a father, the best father. Because it's actually only the love of God that has the power to motivate us to keep his commands. A friend of mine told me about going through the process to become a foster parent. She's at one of these training days, sitting around in a big group, and they asked all of them, how would you handle these different situations? One of the case studies that they're given is of a boy who's been severely neglected by his birth parents, who've been taken away, put into foster care. And his foster parents find that he just steals food all the time and kind of hoards it in his room. And the group is asked, what would you do in this situation? What techniques, what strategies would you use to stop him stealing? And one by one, it kind of goes around the group, and everyone talks about upholding rules and enforcing boundaries, the type of punishment they thought might deter stealing. And then it got to my friend, and she said this. This is just the most amazing answer. She said she would buy him a special box, and she would help him fill that box with food, and they'd find a place in his room where they could hide that box, and they'd decorate it together, and they'd label it as his food box, and that way he'd always know that he'd have enough food. And then if she found him stealing, she would just remind him that he didn't need to do that, because she would always provide him with enough food. And then she would feed him 3 meals a day, every day with snacks in between. And over time, as he grew to trust her and trust her motives towards him were good, and that she was always going to provide for her, she would expect that he wouldn't feel the need to steal anymore and that he wouldn't do it. That over time, he would learn the rules of the house, that there is no need to steal and hide food in this house, because in this house, everyone is given the food that they need. I mean, you won't be surprised to hear that she was approved to be a foster parent. I think maybe almost on the spot, she said that, like, tick, yep, that one, we're having that one. And the amazing thing is she's actually done that with some of the kids that she has fostered. That's one of the first things she does, sets up this box with them. And one of them, she asked him a couple of weeks after being with her, what's the best thing about living with me in this house? And he said, you feed me every single day. I mean, it just breaks your heart to think that some kids don't get that. But anyway, do you know how she came up with this most amazing answer? It was because she had experienced being loved by God in just the same way. And that's the same for all of us. It is God's love for us that motivates us to keep his commandments. I'm not saying that it's wrong or bad to use fear of punishment and a reward system to motivate good behavior. I mean, we use that a lot with Olivia. These things can and they do work. But it is love that has the power to truly change us into the people who want to keep God's commands. Any of you guys like U2? This might be a bit young crowd for that. U2, ask your parents. Yeah. A few years ago, they released an album called How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. They won a Grammy for it. They had the Grammy Awards. They're backstage. And I think it's Michael W. Smith, who's this big Christian artist, like calls over in a mocking tone, hey, Bono, how do you dismantle an atomic bomb? And Bono looks at him. He said, with love, Michael. Of course, with love. And that is true, isn't it? We all have this bomb inside of us that is ready to detonate, to cause pain to ourselves and to others. And the only way to dismantle it is with love. In Deuteronomy 6, Moses says to the Israelites that when their kids come to them and they ask them, why do we do all of this stuff? Why do we keep these funny laws and observe these like funny worship things and all of this kind of stuff? The parents' answer wasn't to be to make us acceptable to God. We've seen that. God had already loved them and chosen them. And it wasn't to be because God says so and he's going to be angry if we don't. Rather, the parents were to tell them the story of the Exodus, the story of the Lord rescuing them, the story of God's love for them. God's love was to be the thing that motivated them to keep his commands. And we have a demonstration of God's love for us, which is even greater than the Exodus was for the Israelites. We, of course, have the cross of Jesus. Yes, the Exodus was great. Yes, it showed the love and power of God. But there was no personal sacrifice involved there. There was no personal cost for God to do that. But the cross cost God everything. It cost him the life of his beloved son. Because the Bible makes it clear that as much as the commands of God have been given for our good, for our flourishing, when we break them, we don't just suffer the consequences of doing things that are bad for us and those around us. There is actually a greater cost that must be paid. If we go back to the last part of the long passage that was read earlier in Exodus 24, we saw there Moses doing something that was a little strange. He reads the Book of the Covenant to the people and then he takes a bowl of blood, oxen blood, and then he sprays it, he flicks it over the people. To us, this seems quite bizarre, but to them, if not completely normal, they understood what was going on, because they lived in an oral and a symbolic culture rather than a written one like ours. God was making a covenant with them. He said, I have rescued you, I have freed you, now obey my commands, and you will always be my people, always enjoy my blessing. I have done this for you, now promise to do that. And the people do. They promise to do everything. And then to ratify a covenant in that culture at that time, you didn't sign your name on a piece of paper. You acted out what would happen to you if you failed to keep it. Breaking the law did not only result in the natural consequences of doing things that are bad for you, it brought with it a divine curse. And the curse of failing to keep the covenant, of breaking the holy law of a holy God, was to have your blood shed. It's a symbol of death, of separation from God and from his people forever. Now we read very soon after of all the failings of the Israelites, all the many ways that they break the laws of God and kind of walk off away from him. And yet time and time again, God forgives them and brings them back into relationship with him. Why is that? How is that possible? Well, it's possible because centuries later, Jesus sat around with a group of men who were completely saturated in the law, who knew the story of the Exodus and the covenant inside and out. And he passed around a cup and some bread. And he said, "Take, eat, this is my body. And then drink of it, all of you. For this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." And then Jesus went out from there and he was arrested and it was a sham trial. And he was beaten and whipped and he was stripped naked and he was hung upon a wooden cross until he was dead. The curse of breaking the covenant fell upon Jesus, the only person who had ever fulfilled it completely, so that we could be forgiven and we could have all the blessings of keeping the covenant fall upon us. This is how we know what love is. Not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. What greater expression of love could there be than the cross? What greater motivation to live a life that pleases the one who died for us? Can I have the band back? We're going to finish our time together by taking communion. We're going to do the same thing that Jesus did that first night with his disciples. We're going to eat bread and we're going to drink wine in remembrance of his sacrifice for us because of his great love for us. We're going to remind ourselves again of the great exchange that happened there, that he suffered the punishment that we should have suffered for breaking God's commandments, so that we might receive the blessings that he should have had for perfectly keeping them. And so now, instead of experiencing separation from God, we can enjoy relationship with him for all eternity. Just to say that we understand that every week here at Christchurch, we have visitors as well as people from a variety of different backgrounds, different stages of faith. If you would like to join us in remembering the death of Jesus, remembering his forgiveness for you, all that means, then please feel very welcome to take the bread and grape juice as it is passed by. Natalie and the band are going to lead us in a song now while the bread and cups are passed out. Just hold on to those for a moment. Andy Tuck will be back in just a minute to talk us through communion. But for now, why don't we stand? I'll just pray for us, and then Natalie and the band will lead us. Father God, I thank you that you are a good father who loves to give good gifts to his children. And we thank you for your commandments. We thank you that you have shown us the way to live, a way to live that is that reflects your character, your nature. And Lord, I thank you that even though we haven't followed all your commands, even though we have broken so many of them, time and time again, I thank you that we can still have relationship with you because of Jesus, because of his sacrifice. And I pray that as we take communion today, as we take bread and wine and remember his death for us, I pray, Holy Spirit, that you will just flood our hearts with an experience of your love for us. The love that took Jesus to the cross and kept him there until it was finished. Father, I pray that we would just know that love now as we eat, as we drink together. Amen.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.